I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing their army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing John E. Mueller from Cato. And he's one of the greats in their foreign policy department there. He's the author of Overblown and Atomic Obsession, Terror, Security, and Money, Capitalism and Democracy. That's interesting. Policy and Opinion in the Gulf War. Boy, I wish I could take a summer off and catch up on all this stuff. How are you doing? Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Happy to have you here, and especially on the occasion of you and John Glazer, my good friend, writing this wonderful thing about, well, if I could quote from your subtitle here, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Boy, that sure sounds familiar.
We found a book called Fool's Errand, which is very helpful in various places.
Oh, that's good. You looked at that, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, so you guys sure have a mini book-length sort of treatise here, Policy Analysis, Overcoming Inertia. It's called, and we're running it at antiwar.com, I think, today.
Great.
Of course, John Glazer, former editor at antiwar.com, good friend of us all. And you guys start out with Barack Obama saying, hey, it's pretty easy to imagine a situation where I leave it on autopilot for the next guy here.
Yeah, you were saying that in 2010. That's, time is up.
Yeah. All right, you know what? So let me try to do this since you read my book and I read this thing. I didn't read the whole thing, but the HTML version you have here, not the whole PDF. But let me start with Andrew McCarthy over at the National Review saying that, you know what? I don't care how tired out you are from all of Bush and Obama's mistakes elsewhere in the Middle East, we still just cannot give up this fight or else Al-Qaeda will come back. The Taliban will laugh in our face and we'll allow them to come back. And the next thing you know, they'll be knocking our towers down again.
Yeah. Is that, did she say that, is that recently?
Yeah, it was just a couple weeks ago, or actually last week, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's the same old thing about the safe haven nonsense. Al-Qaeda never got along the Taliban never really got along with Al-Qaeda, even when they were there. And then it brings their destruction with the thing they said they would not do. They promised the Al-Qaeda when bin Laden came, he promised he wouldn't do either speeches or acts of terrorism. That was the agreement when he got there in 96. And, of course, the coup de grace was 9/11, which is a spectacular violation of that, even though it violated many other ways. And the idea that these guys want these clowns back is crazy, it seems to me. Or, for that matter, would they want to go back there? I mean, if you're in Al-Qaeda Central, you're in Pakistan, at least you know the turf. To pick up and go to one of the world's most impoverished countries that's hostile all over the place, in which the United States knows the turf of really well because it's been there for God knows how long now, 20 years, you probably are better off back in Pakistan.
Yeah. All right, now, so your point one here, stick with the Al-Qaeda thing. I'm sorry, jumping around. There are reports from time to time out of there where they say, oh, we killed a couple of Taliban and a couple of Al-Qaeda guys were with them. Do you think there's anything to that at all?
Well, there are a few in there, yeah. The estimate even of, forget who it was, Defense Secretary of the United States a few years ago, was there might be 100 or something mixed in with the Taliban. The Taliban is tens of thousands. I mean, it's just Mickey Mouse. They don't run anything. The degree to which they're connected is very, very tenuous, to say the least. The Taliban certainly doesn't need these clowns. They're not, you know, Al Qaeda Central in Pakistan has really not done very much since 9/11, after they got spectacularly lucky, horribly lucky on 9/11. The Taliban is running their own show overwhelmingly.
Yeah. So here's another point that Andrew McCarthy made, which goes straight to your point number one here, that the USA can't defeat the Taliban? Exclamation point, question mark, or other way around.
Well,
That's just not right. We got to figure out a way. We should be able to figure out a way to send in enough infantry to, I guess, not do it like the Democrats do it, not do a Petraeus surge, but some other kind of surge, and hit these guys hard enough that they lose. And, you know, if we can defeat the Japanese Empire, we can sure as hell defeat the Taliban. But you say, no, we can't, not at a remotely acceptable cost. So yeah, why not then?
If you want to nuke the whole country, maybe you can get it somewhere close to it. I mean, you couldn't defeat the Viet Cong either, don't forget. Lost ignominiously after 55,000 American lives were there. And also, if you're going to say that, you ought to put up front how many American lives you think it's worth to keep the Taliban to defeat the Taliban. It's like to be very hard. It's basically impossible. If you look at Steve Call's book, for example, on Pakistan, just came out a couple of years ago, they basically can get out of the country anytime they want. They go into Pakistan, they rest and recuperate and come back. And there's a border there between Pakistan and Afghanistan, which would take probably hundreds of thousands of troops. In fact, maybe even that's not enough to basically close off. So they've got a safe haven themselves in Pakistan. If, of course, you want to go to war in Pakistan as well, sending troops there and you're willing to commit World War II type arsenals for this ridiculously unnecessary venture, you might have a case, but I doubt even at that you'd have lots of problems. I mean, the United States has lost consistently. The American military has not defeated anybody since World War II, opponents which are basically pathetic. I mean, gangs of thugs in Panama and in Grenada and to a degree in Kosovo, and then the pathetic army of Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein's army was, as one guy put it at the time, the perfect enemy. It had no leadership, morale, tactics, strategy, or defenses. Otherwise, it was really terrific. So they're good at walking over. They basically have not won against any real opponent since 1945. So the idea that we can do anything we want is demented, it seems to me.
Yeah. Well, especially for the Army, because even in 1945, that was mostly the Reds and the Navy that did that. So... They don't even get credit for that one.
Right.
All right. Now, they sure did help expand the British Empire a million square miles of World War I, though. So you got to give them that. Hey, guys, I know you're going to love Will Griggs' new book we just published at the Libertarian Institute, No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. It's wonderful. It's terrible. It's devastating. You'll laugh. You'll get angry. You'll miss him. You'll be inspired to fight for freedom. With perfect cover art by Scott Alberts and a brilliant introduction by Will's great friend and protege Thomas R. Edlam, it is a fitting legacy for a brilliant man and nearly tireless defender of liberty. Get No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg, in paperback or Kindle on Amazon.com. I guess so. Here is Bill Roggio was quoted in this CNN piece, which claims, by the way, this is the greatest news ever. The headline is here, Trump to meet security officials on Afghanistan. And they have a lot of quotes from Petraeus and other hawks saying we have to stay. But at the end here, they say, sources say this could happen August 19th. Afghanistan's Independence Day is when Khalilzad is planning to put the ink on the final deal with the Taliban to withdraw.
It wouldn't
and so...
Be, it, Well, yeah, it'd be the final, not the final deal, but it'd be the next big step, which is the American drawdown and forces, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then,
numbers were like September 1st, but I don't know.
Yeah, certainly not a deal between the Taliban and the Afghan national government there in Kabul. Although, you're saying that there would still be another few steps to the negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban after this deal?
Yeah, the regime in Kabul has already put together a negotiating team, and the main thing the Taliban wants is the Americans out. After that, then you start dealing with the Kabul government, and there's a lot of steps. I mean, basically, what we argue in this case for the immediate thing is essentially what they seem to be coming close to, which is a ceasefire in place. Which would keep the Taliban where they are and the Kabul government where it is. Mm-hmm. And the biggest hope would be that there's this incredible exhaustion with this war among the Afghan people. There was a ceasefire last year, 2018, in which there was basically a few days in which there was no fighting. And the population was going all over the place talking to both sides saying, stop this stupid thing. Stop it, stop it, stop it. I mean, they just, it didn't matter which side you're talking about. They just wanted to get out of this war and let the Afghans settle it, preferably and hopefully peacefully. But it's obviously not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Now, I mean, of course, the hawks are saying that, come on, all we're going to get here at best is a, quote, decent interval, like in Vietnam, where the South Vietnamese will lose, but after we've left and nobody cares anymore, and the same kind of thing here, and that the Taliban can't be trusted, of course, they're going to, this amounts, as Bill Rogio was saying in this CNN piece from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and I give him some credit, because as a hawk, at least he does know what he's talking about and is a real expert in the war, unlike a lot of these know-nothing hawks, but he's saying, essentially correctly, I guess, that America's hanging our friends out to dry here. That if our army is not there to protect them, then the Afghan national government that we've built, that is the people that we've backed in power, are at risk. And can we do such a thing?
Well, we did it in Vietnam. Now, have you noticed now that we're bosom buddies with the communists in Vietnam against our ferocious pseudo-enemies, the Chinese? And the United States pulled out of Lebanon under Reagan in 1983, and then pulled out of Somalia in 1993, 92, and 93 under Clinton. So it's done that a lot, and in all cases, including the one in Vietnam, the American people really accepted it, or in some cases actually demanded it. So the United States has pulled out the rug among other people. There's a thing about when you're in over your head, what you should try to do is cut your losses and get out, and that's what would be happening here. Yeah. If the Taliban take over, the world will not come to an end. They will not invite al-Qaeda back. In fact, that's going to be part of the deal, apparently. They're going to promise that. I don't think they even need to, because they don't want those bastards back. Then the hope is that the Afghans will be able to work it out. There may be a decent interval. In fact, we use that analogy, the Vietnam thing. Mm. It may just collapse in a couple of years and Taliban take over, though they're not probably really strong enough to do that. It depends if the Afghan army just totally collapses, then maybe they could, in which case you'd have the Taliban there. And that having the Taliban there and a relatively stable situation is better than this endless war that the people are protesting.
Mm.
In general, the Taliban have done a better job of governing in the areas they've been in than in the extremely well-funded and unbelievably corrupt government we've got. Steve Call has one thing, just sort of the epitome, unbelievable epitome of corruption. Mm-hmm. There are Afghan soldiers who are starving to death in hospitals in Kabul because the money that was there to provide food for them has been stolen by the administrators. That's the wonderful administration we're fighting and dying for.
Yeah. There was this study. I'm not sure if you guys noticed this. It came out, I'm pretty sure, 1 year ago by a lady named Ashley Jackson, who had been traveling all around the Taliban-dominated areas of the country. And she talked about I don't know if it was the CIA or the military, killed the previous Taliban leader in a drone strike, that the new guy... I forget how to say his name, Akhundzada, something like that. that he's really changed their strategy to very much a counterinsurgency doctrine type of a way of doing things, only not a pathetic joke like when McChrystal and Petraeus try it. But instead, for example, he said instead of attacking the schools or the police chiefs or the mayors or whatever, we will just take over all of these institutions and we'll just have Taliban teachers in the schools that the Americans built. And we'll just make sure that only a Taliban guy can get the job as police chief, or someone who's loyal to them can get the job as police chief in this town or the other. So, in other words, they're just usurping the entire structure of the government, such as America has been able to build in those parts of the country, rather than fighting against them.
Yeah,
and that this has been a huge advantage for them. And this is a big part of what's responsible for them going to controlling 40 to 60% of the country in about a year there.
Right. Not necessarily the population, but of the country. Yeah, there's been several reports coming out indicating that they're running the place where they run it. There's a competition. They're running it much less corruptly and much, much more effectively than is the government in Kabul. And if it can't get its act together, is it really something we want to support?
Mm. Even Petraeus himself admitted that was true, that the people preferred their own traditional court systems and chiefs and whatever to the way we were doing it for them.
Right.
Hang on just one second for me. Hey, guys, you know, you probably need a new website. A lot of people do. What you need to do then is go to expanddesigns.com. The great Harley Abbott and his team over at expanddesigns.com. They'll hook you up with a great new website for 2019. And in fact, what you really should do is type in expanddesigns.com/Scott, and you'll save $500. Now, I guess, so this really is kind of a problem politically, and I guess I'm really grateful that so far Trump seems to be sticking to his guns, at least in terms of telling Khalilzad to really see this through. I mean, if Khalilzad didn't think that he had 100% support of the president thus far, he would not have pushed things as far as he had at all. I have to assume that. It's sort of speculation, but it seems like they've really agreed that they really want to do this. But like we talked about, there's a lot of problems, you know, capable of cropping up after we leave there. No one really knows how bad the war might get or whether a ceasefire might hold or might not, or these kinds of things. And so it's a really big risk, as James Mattis told him back when he announced the surge 2 years ago, that, hey, if anything bad happens after you leave, I'm going to blame it on you. It's going to be your fault. And so we have to stay forever, essentially. And that worked 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But that's really what he's up against. And this was a big part of the problem back in Vietnam, right? Was you just, politically speaking, no individual politician is willing to risk being weak on terrorism. So if that means killing Pashtuns from now on, then they'll do that.
Well, there was a lot of support among the American people for getting out, of course. And not only is Trump seemed to be on that line, but so are virtually all the Democratic candidates for president. So, and there's no stomach in the United States for continuing this thing if it costs American lives further. The Afghan thing, I mean, the Vietnam analogy really fits magnificently in this case. What happened was that there was a decent interval that you mentioned. The United States got out in 1973, and in 1975, 2 years later, the Viet Cong took over and the South Vietnamese fought almost not at all, ended in 55 days. So that was under Gerald Ford that this great debacle in American political history, foreign policy history, took place. The next year, he was up for re-election, 1976. And I sat through that very carefully, waiting for them to bring up Vietnam. And the only time in the whole campaign that Vietnam even came up in the presidential debates was when Ford brought it up. He said, when I came into office in 1974, we were still involved in the war in Southeast Asia, and now no Americans are fighting anywhere, and we're not associated with any wars anywhere. In other words, he's taking it as a point of pride that he stood over this disaster in Vietnam. And instead of being thrown out for that, he was taking credit for it. And yet it was a big thing, too. It wasn't just sort of a passing thing. It was in his prepared remarks, you know, either at the beginning or at the end of one of the debates. Jimmy Carter's opponent said, well, let's talk about farm price supports, you know, and I didn't do anything about criticizing it. Nor, again, the United States has gotten out of Lebanon, as I mentioned, and got out of Somalia, and there was no retribution to anybody, you know, either Reagan in the first case or Clinton in the second.
Yeah. Well, and especially since he's a Republican, and I think, you know, to some degree, this whole argument that he's somehow loyal to Russia or some other, you know, thing than his own self and his own job is wearing off, that maybe he really could, if he could wrap up Afghanistan, maybe he could get us out of Somalia again. We've been back there since 2001.
Yeah, well, the amount we're there, it's not with full troops, and you know, it's basically special forces and advising and drone strikes and things.
Yeah.
So the United States is involved in a whole bunch of little dinky wars around the world. I mean, not that they're small wars, but they're involved in a fairly small profile in a number of them. And of course, they've also withdrawn both from Iraq and substantially from Afghanistan. There are very few Americans being killed anymore.
Mm. Yep. Well, and you know what, too, like you say about Gerald Ford there, I mean, it goes to show that Nixon, I mean, he got elected on his secret plan to end the war anyway, so he probably could have pulled that same stunt right away instead of putting it off. But in this case, it seems so obvious that if Trump wants to be reelected, that at least on the foreign policy front, well, never mind his trade stuff. But, well, yeah, what he does have to brag about, he has a lot to not brag about, but what he does have to brag about is, for example, trying to make peace with North Korea. Whether he gets any further by election day, I don't care. That's still the best thing about him so far. And then if he really could pull troops all the way out of Afghanistan and America's involvement in that war to a real degree like that and wants to run on I ended the Afghan war, that kind of thing, and especially if he wants to go ahead and add Syria, Iraq, and Somalia to the list, which he could do if he insisted he is the president, mm-hmm. that's the best way for him to get reelected. He'd probably back off Iran a bit, too, maybe.
Yeah, right. But he's not directly at war with Iran, but yes, that's right. Well, maybe he is in some sense. Yeah, I think the American, you know, we're now ensconced deeply in the in what I called a long time ago the Iraq syndrome. And like the Vietnam syndrome, so let's not do that again. And that was the syndrome continued after the Vietnamese utter defeat, debacle, in 1975. And I think the syndrome will continue no matter what happens in Afghanistan if Americans aren't being killed. The real nightmare, from my standpoint, would not be a Taliban takeover, and we talk about that in this paper, which is available online free from Cato. In other words, like after the Soviets left, the country fell apart into this colossal, disastrous civil war, which was finally put down by the Taliban in 1996. However, the Soviet forces left, but they continued to support financially the government in Kabul, and it stood on its feet for a few years until the Soviets pulled out their financial support. So the suggestion on that is, if the United States continues to financially support the Afghan government, it'll probably be able to hang in there for a while and work out some sort of deal potentially with the Taliban. We can find out, but it's less likely than it seems to me that there's going to be this total disaster of not just the Taliban, but everybody fighting everybody, warlords and so forth all over the country.
Yeah.
But that would be the nightmare solution. That would be the nightmare conclusion. It is possible the war to be even worse than it is.
Right.
And against that, you have to put up against, you know, do you want to really want to continue this war year after year after year after year year after year? And there is, as we say in the piece, there is a risk that would happen, but we think it's manageable and pretty small.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you mentioned, they took over much of the country, including the capital, in 1996. But at the time of American intervention on the Northern Alliance's side, in 2001, at the end of 2001, the Taliban still had not consolidated control over the whole country after 5 years.
That's
after
right.
Taking the capital. So they presumably have some institutional memory of how much it takes to try to dominate in those areas. And they've been able to see just how hard it's been for the Tajiks and the Uzbeks and the Hazaras to dominate them in their own land this whole time. And, you know, Matthew Ho, the State Department whistleblower, former Marine Corps captain and all that from the Afghan War.
Yeah.
He talked about how, you know, in the 90s, It was the U.S., Saudi, and Pakistan were supporting the Taliban and encouraging them. The Bill Clinton State Department was even on the record saying they didn't want a peace deal. They wanted the Taliban to completely defeat the Northern Alliance and consolidate control over the entire country. And they were backing Pakistan's policy and helping to make that happen. But in this case, presumably, we would not have that. And the Pakistanis, at America's request, would be telling the Taliban, listen, we'll support you up to here, but no further, hopefully, kind of thing, right? So maybe that really, it's an optimistic take, but maybe that really could make the difference in drawing a line of autonomy where the Taliban get to rule Pashtunistan, but the other factions get to rule where their populations, you know, have grassroots support for them.
Yeah, there's a considerable amount of evidence that the Taliban has become more pragmatic and less ideologically or religiously severe. Including some of the people they've appointed to the negotiating table. One guy basically was arrested 10 years ago. One of the Taliban people was arrested by the Pakistanis 10 years ago because he was working to get a peace deal in Afghanistan. Now, under the pressure of the Americans, the Pakistanis have released him, and he's now the lead negotiator. He's generally regarded as being very, you know, he was very much a crony of Omar at the beginning. But he's, you know, he's, in other words, he's a true believer in many respects, but he's also very pragmatic and sensible. So, and there seem to be other people in the negotiating team, experts point out, that have similar points of view. There's also been some indications that the Taliban is willing to even compromise a degree on women's rights and things like that. So, you know, if they can get out of this war cleanly and have a complicated governmental structure, in other words, with a lot of regionalism, which has always been the case in Afghanistan anyway, there might be a solution that Afghans can work out and that Americans are probably incapable of putting together anyway. And also, the biggest recruiting device for the Taliban has been we've been invaded by the Westerners and they wanted to destroy us. If the Americans are not there in the military form, that recruitment slogan will have far less effect than it does now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you also have point four in your piece here. Defeat in Afghanistan would not necessarily destabilize the region. And I think, you know, as we're talking about, even if the Taliban took over the whole country, indications lately are that the Russians and the Iranians, who historically have, of course, hated the Taliban and their side in this whole thing, are now looking at them as the moderate rebels compared to the Islamic State there. And so it looks like there's a possibility not just for the U.S., but really for the regional allies, even if the U.S. was gone, to have their own little awakening movement there. We'll support the local Sunni-based insurgency as long as you get rid of the foreign fighters for us. And that was the smartest thing anybody did in this war this whole 20 years was when Petraeus accepted the Sunnis' offer of ceasefire there in 2007. Right. So maybe something like that could be replayed.
Yeah, the hostility toward the ISIS group is intense, and it affects both Russia and China, who have Islamist extremist concerns within their own countries, and as well as potentially other countries like Pakistan. And so, in many respects, a stable Afghanistan, and also China wants to use Afghanistan for part of its, you know, Silk Road initiative, you know, Great Belt and Road initiative. So it basically, and Iran doesn't need that kind of chaos on its border either. And Pakistan also, as I pointed out earlier, seems to be on board as well. So you've got pretty much everybody, all the countries in the area who would really like to see this thing ended. And some sort of stable, if type of government and arrangement be worked out there. So the idea, I mean, this idea that the Taliban is going to collapse, is take over, and then they'll bring back Al Qaeda, and then they'll join, and they'll attack, you know, Pakistan, and take over the nuclear weapons and so forth. I mean, just unbelievably worst case scenario fantasies being thrown around, including by Petraeus in some respects, but certainly by also by Max Boot. On that, I just think it's just not, doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Well, you got my vote. sounds pretty good here. and it very well put together piece, as always, by you guys over there at the Cato Foreign Policy Department. I'm not sure what's going on in some of those other departments, but anyway, this is great work here. Overcoming inertia. Why it's time to end the war in Afghanistan. Very convincing. Very well put together piece here. So thank you again for coming on the show to talk about it.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks very much.
All right, you guys. That's John Mueller. He's at Cato.org. He wrote this with the great John Glazer. It's called Overcoming Inertia, Why It's Time to End the War in Afghanistan. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at LibertarianInstitute.org, at ScottHorton.org, AntiWar.com, and Reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.